The difference between machines and humans, and this is key to culture mapping as well, true intelligence is a social function. It's about social cohesion. And so, like, intelligence happens in groups. It does not happen in individuals.
Welcome to the Amplifying Cognition podcast. I am Ross Dawson, a futurist and entrepreneur fascinated by the unlimited potential of the human mind. In this podcast, we learn from amazing people how to think better and build better organizations in our massively accelerating world. We explore what's possible, how to augment ourselves, and ultimately, who we can become. We also build platforms and tools to help people amplify their cognition. These include the Humans Plus AI Explorers community, where pioneers share how they are augmenting their capabilities with AI, my AI Enhanced Thinking and Decision-Making cohort course, which goes deep into these practices and how they're applied, and our ThoughtWeaver app for AI-augmented thinking workflows. To find out about these, my corporate work, or to access our newsletter and free book chapters and many other free resources, just go to amplifyingcognition.com. In this episode, we speak with the fascinating Tim Stock. Tim is an expert in analyzing how cultural trends and artificial intelligence intersect. He is co-founder of Scenario DNA and the co-inventor of a patented culture mapping methodology that analyzes patterns in culture using computational linguistics. He teaches at the Parsons School of Design in New York. And I'm sure if you've seen any of his work, you'll know that some fascinating insights come out of it. You can see more about what he does at scenariodna.com. In this episode, we talk about culture mapping, the culture of generative AI and how that's evolving, intelligence as a social function, learning from subcultures, and a whole array of topics around this intersection of culture, AI, and how we can see the future better. Stay tuned for an awesome conversation with Tim Stock.
Tim, it's awesome to have you on the show.
Really great to be here.
So I think people need a bit of context for our conversation in understanding the work you do, which a lot of it centers around culture mapping. So, Tim, tell us, what is culture mapping?
Culture mapping has its roots in understanding what is going on underneath the surface that people aren't paying attention to. So, essentially, when we speak to whoever I need to explain culture mapping to, it's that we help companies understand how and why culture is changing and how to use that information to make better design and business decisions. And so a lot of those kind of real changes in culture are not obvious. They're not things that we can ask people about. So they're the weaker signals. And so culture mapping allows us to be able to map the relationship between what is the broader culture and subcultures and understand the relationship between those and how they develop narratives within society and cultural change.
So what's the state of today? So what are some of the signals you're seeing in the your culture mapping work?
Well, I think that, you know, we're in a particular moment where we're shifting from one kind of age to another especially in terms of how people do work, how we understand our relationship to identity. There's a growing nihilism, I would argue, that's going on. And I think that, you know, when people say a lot of when we're talking about things that are happening, the negativity that people would say is coming out of the pandemic. But again, if you see from a culture mapping standpoint, those signals were actually there already. But that those externalities of the pandemic just really exacerbated them. So things like, sort of issues around how we see work and how we understand our relationship to work, has a lot to do how technology is changing. It has a lot to do with the kind of work the kinds of skills, all of these kinds of affordances that go along with that. And essentially, culture is always trying to catch up to that particular change. And so at this particular moment, I say we're kind of stuck. There's a moment where we haven't found our voice yet. And so it's the reason why you see a lot of this kind of, you know, there's political dysfunction, there's issues in terms of, I mean, we're at a moment where there's a lot of there's a lot of unrest and there's a lot of language around that. And so essentially I see us trying to, as a society, trying to find that voice.
So, I mean, yeah, there's a couple of directions for this. We're looking at the role of generative AI. One is from a cultural response. Another is, I suppose, at a deeper level, as to our individual understanding of what is our relationship with generative AI.
Yeah, I mean, it comes down to what do we do? And I think that's you know, that nihilism is emerging from, well, what am I supposed to do? We've co-opted a lot of these words like intelligence. So what is left for humans to do? And the state of AI, I would say, is that you would see that there's a lot of replacing and mimicking human actions. We get sort of things that look like they're creative. The word creativity, for example, has been co-opted and sort of like, so, but, you know, we're at a point where we need to be asking, what is really creative? I mean, creativity is a human action. Human intelligence emerges differently than machine intelligence. Machines don't see ghosts. Machines don't understand, machines can't believe in conspiracies in the same ways that humans can. Humans see in between. And it's how we access information, learning as children, how we acquire language, and how intelligence is so tied into narrative in that particular way. But right now, what we see is a lot of replacing of things that we normally would do. So the question is, especially if you're a young person today, you'd be like, well, what should I learn? What are the kinds of skills? There's nobody to tell you because it hasn't actually been framed to be able to understand. So in a way, there's a lot of shift towards the individual. We're seeing sort of in every area, from medicine to education to work, we see the individual now having to take on much more responsibility. And I think that causes a lot of anxiety. And so, that's the moment we're in until we sort of figure out, well, how are we actually going to use these tools that are sort of more collectively? I don't think we've figured out the collective part of that.
Yes. Yes. Last year I created this, mapping intelligence framework. And my first response as we started to look at ChatGPT was that we actually don't really know what we mean when we say intelligence. Essentially that the humans are the reference point. So there's, this debate where we happen to come up with the phrase and use the phrase artificial intelligence all the way through. Whereas if it could be for an accident of history, you might've called it cybernetics or some other phrase, which would have given us a completely different frame. But because it is artificial intelligence, its objective has always been to copy, yes, to replicate or try to be the same as human, yes, intelligence. Which means it puts us in a challenging situation now when these are tools which can augment us. And, Doug Engelbart talked about the augmenting intelligence instead of the intelligence, artificial intelligence, intelligence augmentation instead of artificial intelligence. So this, in a way, requires a cultural and linguistic reframing so that we can move to the amplifying cognition type positive frames.
Well, it's a culture mapping exercise because, I mean, so much of what is, currently broken in AI and generative AI is that, I mean, it's been programmed. It is one framework. It has walls and it is defined. Its language is defined by the engineers that defined it. And the rules that it lives by what we consider intelligence is what an engineer would consider to be intelligent, which would be to be able to replicate or so forth. Speak to an artist or speak to a poet and you get a very different answer. And you almost get this, we're seeing very ideological kind of battle going on, a sort of reclaiming kind of ownership over how these models are actually trained and so forth. But, you know, more simple than that, what do we consider to be intelligent? When I think of ChatGPT, I like to think of it, it's the perfect way of sort of measuring intelligence because, you know, what you should be saying, you know, we all kind of go through this when we'll put something into ChatGPT, it should be like, God, that's stupid. Like that, why isn't that better? That's, you know, our ability. The problem is that we're too accepting of these answers. And I think that we sort of, and there is that part of us as human beings. I mean, the difference between machines and humans, and this is key to culture mapping as well, true intelligence is a social function. It's about social cohesion. And so like intelligence happens in groups. It does not happen in individuals. So I think that we have this, you know, this idea that individuals kind of create this, you know, great things in our society. It happens in groups. It happens in these subcultures of groups that create that kind of knowledge. Machines can't do that. But the problem is that we also can be, sort of swayed towards accepting bad information. It's how conspiracies happen. And so like, that's the moment we're at where we have to be more aware, in a way, using, when I think of augmenting our intelligence, I think of, you know, it's always interesting bringing up it, you know, bring up AI in sort of certain cases. And it's like, you know, the case in terms of dating, you know, the idea of being able to sort of date versions of all, you know, to date versions of yourself to stop you from making the same mistakes and so forth. It's like learning throughout this process of almost helping you to be the person that you actually want to be. But the thing is that most of the things in society actually allow us to sort of copy and sort of double down on these bad habits. And I see, in a way, so much in AI is doing that. The internet didn't have that problem. Generative AI is too quick. It's almost like the arc of adoption is so fast. And so with the internet, it allowed to stay in the subculture space much longer. So it was able to kind of get that kind of live, you know, the whole cyberpunk and all of these other kind of surveillance culture and everything. And there's so many cypherpunks and everything emerging. With AI now, it's almost like it's immediate to meme. It's like it goes from zero to cottagecore in 2 seconds. And it's like then everything looks the same. And we go, well, isn't that okay? And we go, well, if I said no, will I be wrong? And people don't want to be wrong. And so they're like, we're almost kind of affirming a lot of this sort of negative aspects of it right now.
Yes, yes, absolutely. So I'm saying a lot these days that the biggest risk with AI is over-reliance, where we sort of say, oh, that's good. And we just leave it at that. And we don't exert our own cognitive capabilities or, you know, stop when it starts going, you know, not being as good as it could be. But I think it goes back to your point around intelligence being a social function. And one aspect of that is that many people find it very useful to be in dialogue with AI. You know, you can refine your ideas and have a useful conversation, you know, sometimes from a emotional perspective, sometimes from a, you know, just an idea generation perspective. But it is still, essentially, it is not a true counterpart. And I don't think you can have the same dialogue.
And you can't. And the other part of it, key to this, Ross, that's different, is the fact that we're having a dialogue, and the dialogue you want to have with that, it's sort of like, I want to get better, I want to improve something. But the thing is that normally within social behavior is that you do that, and if you then begin to disagree, then you create other subgroups of people that believe your particular idea, and you develop a whole group and ideology around that, and that becomes its own area of development. You get tools, you get other kinds of technologies that way. The problem is that we're almost creating this very linear, and there's no divergence. I mean, the key to intelligence is actually divergence. It's not to affirm what's there. It's actually to push away from that and to do something that is, you know, diversity is key to our biological health. And like, it's the same in terms of intelligence, is that human beings by nature, tell them to do something and that they actually have this ingrained in them to actually move away from that. If we make it easier to be like everybody else, we're diluting and diluting and diluting our intelligence in that process. So in a way, the internet was a form of AI because it was all of these subgroups actually working this collective intelligence in that way, understanding how to sort of come back to that in some way with these augmented, these, you know, hugely sort of transformative augmenting tools like generative AI, artificial intelligence, is that would be what we would really need to.
Taking a very quick break, this podcast is just one facet of our work to amplify human cognition. If you're interested in thinking better in a world of overload, using AI to augment yourself, finding like-minded thinkers, or improving your organization's performance, just go to amplifyingcognition.com. You'll find a wealth of free resources and useful tools. Now, back to the show.
Yes, well, I love what you're saying you know, intelligence is diversity or is grounded in diversity. And that can be one of the useful functions. I mean, a lot of asking for diverse perspectives from generative AI on a particular situation is one of my favorite tools. And so, hadn't thought of it that way. And that is something additional, but it is complementary to my cognition, it's not the machine doing the intelligence. It might come up with a random, useful, unuseful, but I'm the one who's passing it. But it is useful to get those perspectives. But this, in a way, comes back to how can we do this as well as possible? And to your point, I think there's conceivably a homogenization of thought of some kind, which is potentially emerging from this. So how can we use these tools to augment, to amplify, or perhaps even a better word is extend our thinking, as opposed to having it channeled into narrower conduits?
Well, one fundamental sort of step that can be taken is recognizing what tasks to give AI to do and recognize, in intelligence, AI can be incredibly valuable because one of the things that, you know, human beings have biases. And so in a way, in terms of in decision making, they will begin to believe things that are actually against the decision that actually needs to be made. And so we almost affirm that is that there are parts of this rational area for AI that actually allow us to sort of, what are these rational things that we need to do? When we start mixing the rational with the creative and so forth, we kind of mix these two things together. We should be focused on the interpretive, the deciphering part, and actually upping our game in terms of our deciphering, our analysis ability, as opposed to taking what AI is giving us as analysis, because it isn't. It's actually just an output of whatever might be flawed in our existing analysis and the input that we put into it. So we need to be a bit better at that.
So how do we get there? How do we get better at that kind of, call it meta-analysis?
Well, it's a topic that is very much, hot within in the intelligence community, which is, they have this thing called structured analytic technique, but nobody uses it. And the idea is that if you have structure, the problem is that we have these, the intelligence community has a methodology of structuring analysis and being able to say, what are we doing? What are we sort of putting off to kind of machines and computational analysis and so forth? But then we kind of go back and say, well, I trust my gut on this. And, I'm just going to go with my gut on this. And that we have to now recognize that so much more, how much faster things can go wrong if we don't slow it down, structure it. So structure, I would say, Ross, is absolutely critical, which goes back to, I would say, culture mapping, which is essentially a way of structuring language to say, if you were to talk about any one concept, people would say, oh, well, I know what you mean. Culture mapping is to say, wait a minute. No, there are actually many different other implied meanings to what you think that I'm talking about. And understanding that structure is important because then we start recognizing, you know, why certain things go wrong in society. And I could give you one example right now is that we have an existential threat of climate change. And we have, over the last 10 years, you know, developed programs like, you know, ESG, all these different kinds of language around this. And when we've done that, we've actually created a counterpoint. So right now, there is as much of an ideological movement against all of what we've created towards dealing with these sustainability issues that relate to climate change. And we can't, and you can't battle them. Like there are people who fight against, you know, 15-minute cities, or there are people who fight against vaccinations. I was just reading today, you know, anti-fluoridation is back in the United States. It's sort of like, you know, any science, any, you know, that the irrationality of human beings come because, and it's not wrong. It's the fact that what you've done is you've led something that should be very structured in an emotional way. You've packaged it and you've expected that everybody would believe you and everybody would come around. But actually, change happens socially. And you have to understand to be able to deal with the future is understanding the way, all the different ways things are going to change as externalities change, as all the different contexts, as the context changes. And people are going to have different kind of ideological responses. You need to be able to have a structure to say, I have some scenarios for how that might particularly play out. You know, we saw a lot of these particular signals with the recession, and they begin. You know, it was really clear, but nobody was paying attention to them, and so if they were there. And then the pandemic hits, and then it's like then they're so obvious. Now they become really, really obvious. But it's the structure that you need to say, how do we then put solutions to understand what you're actually dealing with, because you're actually dealing with people and different groups of people. Everybody isn't the same. Everybody's not going to believe what you believe, and you have to deal with that kind of variability within society.
So pulling this towards, you know, collective intelligence or group intelligence, I suppose, you know, part of the subtext here is being intelligence, as you say, is a social function, not a far more than an individual function. And with these kinds of existential challenges or more complex challenges that we have, you know, we do need to build a collective intelligence that is superior to individual intelligence. That has to be the path to our collective future. So in that guise, you know, what are the ways in which these new intelligences that we have, how can we best build the best of human, particularly human group intelligence, augmented by or supported by some of these new tools?
Well, I think, I mean, for us, it's that, you know, it's being able to see those subcultures that are in, that make up the society. We sort of think of society as a monolith, or we think of society as being demographically based. It's sort of divided by age, or it's divided by ethnicity, or divided by, it's actually divided by these particular relationships to these subcultures, whether you're directly related to them or not. And for anything that's changing within society, there's always, this is the point of culture mapping, is that there's always this process between affirming codes of society, and then there's always this counterpoint that's always happening. So as language becomes sort of static and becomes the rule and the law, is that there's always this counterpoint. So being able to understand and invest and understand what that response is, not capitalize on it, not commercialize it, but understand what it is. I'll give you an example that work that we did back a little bit over 10 years ago. And it was that, you know, looking at bicycles in cities, and, you know, bicycles as a machine was understood as being a leisure product that is sold everywhere. But actually, these subcultures of cycling that had been sort of living under the surface were telling you how cities needed to be planned. They were telling you how they needed to function, how adaptable they needed, and not just sort of just mobility, but also things like food. It's sort of, you start getting other codes of behavior that go with that. There are different researchers during the pandemic that studied skaters, like skateboarders, and made connections between understand skateboarders and you understand how to help people age in place. Because one of the biggest issues globally is that we're living longer, and that it's very difficult for people, if they're living into their 80s and 90s, to live in the home that they're in. They, you know, because the city is the town that they're in isn't planned that way. Do you understand adaptability? Do you understand how things need to function? You need to look at those parts of the culture that are telling you how these things need to change. There was the same thing with our mobile devices. You know, we didn't have VPNs, but there were subcultures that were telling us that privacy was an issue with the technology, while everything technology companies were telling us, what are you so worried about? Why can't we put a camera on everything? And why are you so freaked out about that? Well, there were subcultures telling us, and even things like right to repair. I mean, right, you know, why can't I fix my phone? You know, all of those things are there all the time, but we don't pay attention to them. And we have to understand, we have to sort of, in a way, a collective intelligence is one that really embraces the full range of what society is, and doesn't sort of force it to conform to kind of the model that we have, which is currently what we've done. I mean, demographics, sort of like everybody sort of, you know, fits within a certain box. We've had that model since after, you know, from the 20th century. It's sort of like it shapes polling, it shapes so many decisions that society makes, but it actually does, it's giving us less and less good result. You know, it gets it wrong more and more and more of the time. You know why? Because people now don't, you know, they don't fit nicely in those boxes, and the speed of change is so fast. It's like, and how they're influenced, the range by which people are influenced is so much broader because of technology. We have to understand the full breadth of society to be able to do that. That's what a living foresight model is. That is what collective intelligence to me would be.
Well, I think to your point, what I take from there is, in a way, you know, the traditional framing of collective intelligence is you put a bunch of individuals together and you architect ways in which together they can be more intelligent together. But is saying, well, perhaps the units that you are working with are subcultures. And so you might have a group of people that think a particular way, and another group of people think quite a different way, another group of people thinking in completely different dimensions. Mm-hmm. And it's linking together those subcultures, which represent a frame on the world, or a way of perceiving things, or a way of sense-making. And it's bringing together those cultures out of which true collective intelligence can emerge, rather than looking at it as this aggregation of individuals.
Yes, I mean, I think we tend to think, you know, we think in these boxes too much. I mean, for example, I mean, you know, take, you know, everybody's talking about the future of work right now. And there are really practical issues related to that, because it's like, it comes down to, what is an office for? You know, what, like, we have all this real estate that we suddenly, the pandemic sort of whacked, and you go like, oh, well, what am I going to use that for? Oh, well, we're going through this nihilistic phase where we're going to force everybody to come back and we're going to surveil them. Okay, good luck with that over, I'll give you how much time. Underneath the surface, I'm telling you, there are these other ways in which people are actually sharing intelligence and solving problems. It's why, like, there are different, I mean, it's before I've been talking about this, there are many different kinds of companies and that have sort of tapped into the intelligence within video games, for example, because, and how people, and, you know, and they've even sort of brought that into, you know, and this brought that into how you know, tasks and sort of problem solving is done within a company, But you start dealing with, those are the essential issues of dealing with even more abstract issues like the relationship between physical space and virtual space, and realizing there is no, there isn't physical or virtual. Now we're dealing with this emergence of something called fourth space. It's, you know, which is this where we're digital and physical at the same time. And, you know, who understands that first? Who could give me a framework for that? Well, I need to be able to tap into those particular groups, because that's going to tell me how to make what an office should be. It's not going to look anything like what we currently have. It may be a park, or it might be a mall, or it might be, you know, because people are going to, what do they do when they go to work? They communicate. And more and more of work is becoming kind of a grazing, more than it is sort of the idea of a meeting. We sort of do shorter, it's shorter kind of creative kind of conversations, and then we go and do our tasks. One of the things that the pandemic taught everybody is, what the hell is 9 to 5? Why do I have to work 5 days a week if I can get all my work done in 2 days or whatever? So the idea of time has changed. So you get all of these kinds of concepts are constantly changing in society, but we're not keeping up with the cultures that actually define what that meaning is. And the subcultures are those groups that actually are ahead, and we need to sort of understand, because then the rest of society pulls that in, like they did with privacy, because it's sort of like they, you know, the average person didn't understand the, you know, privacy is very abstract, but they kind of go, who has this, who's ahead on this? And they start pulling in those behaviors, and then they start becoming normalized, and they become habit, and habit becomes culture. And that's the issue. So studying that kind of relationship between what is the general culture and subculture is what's really, 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 really critical.
So is there anything which you would finish off with as advice or suggestions for listeners based on what your work or what you're seeing or what you do?
Well, I would say that, you know, there's a lot of opportunity within with generative AI. And I also teach I've been teaching a course in trend analysis for going on 20 years now, in which I have integrated generative AI. But it's recognizing how we can integrate these tools that so we're not replacing what we do. So in a way, right now, what I'm hopeful for is that, there's a great opportunity for kind of a renaissance in education, and sort of defining what kind of skills that we need. And I think these tools can be incredibly valuable in doing that. So I would say, like, recognize kind of what the potential is, and don't forget that we should be actually raising the bar as human beings in terms of what we consider to be intelligence, what we consider to be creativity at this particular moment.
Yes, 100% agree. So where can people find out more about your work, Tim?
You can go to scenariodna.com. I have a blog that's related to a class I teach called analyzingtrends.com, which I have not posted as much lately, but there is that as well.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for your insights and all of the work you do.
Oh, great. Great talking to you, Ross.
Thank you for listening to the show. If you found it useful, it would be super helpful if you could just hop into your app and give us a rating or even a quick review. It makes a massive difference for others being able to find us. Thank you for your support and for listening. Much appreciated. Wishing you all the best on your journey to augmented cognition.